Sunday, April 14th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will feature award-winning poet, playwright, essayist, and recording artist Carl Hancock Rucks. Join us as we discuss many things, including upcoming Apollo Theater dates and his latest release, Homeostasis. That's Sunday, April 14th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. Let's get ready for Carl Hancock Rucks. Thank you, Carl Hancock Rucks, for helping this program happen, because you are something else. And you have got a new release. Carl Hancock Rucks has a new release. It's called Homeostasis. We'll be talking about it, but you just have to hang out for the show to find out more. And Carl Hancock Rucks will be at the Apollo on the 19th and the 20th of this month, Friday and Saturday. Stay tuned to find out more about that. Or you can go to sugarinmybowl.org. That's S-U-G-A in my bowl. www.sugarinmybowl.org. Stay tuned. Oh, by the way, this next song is for Hank Williams.
In my bowl.
Hell no, ain't no, ain't no, hell no, won't be no blackmail show today. No metaphor, no right image, no mirrors cracked or otherwise. Wait in line for your givings back, for your cracked jaw. For Mingus is devil woman and won't be no sweet backs or badass songs. No return on investments, no exchange on reefer butts and PhDs. Not responsible for lost items purchased with piss and prayer. Not responsible for the representation of your friends. Not responsible for right reflections. Not responsible. What it mean, the four green landlords? No one Cain called you prophet, called you nigger, called you holy, called you out. What it mean, the four green women who refused to make you a sandwich on a bristly day, slip they, smile between the slices. What it mean to their wetness when you come dry? They give you a basket of fruit and rhythm, but you done forgot how to peel and scat today. You see, Little Kim is not at home waiting for you in thong and lip gloss with Foxy Brown, who is also not at home waiting for you. They do not call you to discuss their reinvented ideas of black blue-collar contemporary feminism in popular culture and its influence on Versace and Prada. Wasn't nobody gonna call the law down to take a poet from the cross? The law ain't gonna bring back no expatriate poets to lay hands on Slick Rick, resurrect the corpse of Shakur from his gilded tomb. See, the law is a free dealer. The law is a high-stakes woman. The law is a conquistador conjure man. The law is a primetime sitcom infiltrator. The law is a boy boilerplate bestseller. The law is a double-headed rabble rouser. The law is a grand slam thank you man talk show host. The law is a New York Times Sunday art section page full of diss and discourse, employing De La Soul as hitman to hammer the last nail in the hand of gangster rap in the name of Nas. Praz is chillin', while hip-hop happens to be illin', living at number one on the charts if you just turn the page. As if hip-hop was never a valid form, as if it was last year's leopard print go-go wear, as if it was modern-day prophecy on a revolutionary tip. 90210 blue-eyed Bloomingdale's billionaire babes are dressed in red and blue bandanas, hues of blood and lead lining the branded skins of terracotta walls. Assuming those musicians of hip-hop tics never read Cruz or Vygotsky, never heard what Larry Neal was really saying was really for real, see? As if blood and guts and rhythm was only quid pro quo if Mel Gibson was naked and painted on horseback. See, violence was invented by postmodern revolutionaries and never had nothing to do with the way these divided states was formed. See, postmodern upper echelon middle America cannot understand how the proletariat could be on Jerry Springer talking out loud about their business, personal affairs. Who really cares beyond the ratings? Buddies who welcome you back from your European tour with beer and blow. You be composing broken bilingual dramatic and lyric verse about Bakongo slaves, singing ancient freedom and resistance songs in the silver mines of Zaquetas and the sugar plantations of Veracruz, building yourselves a new land. You and your Latino buddies know we the same nigga, us, speaking one same nigga language in one same nigga neighborhood. We the same nigga descendants of the same nigga souls from across the water, brought back together in urban nigga realities. And the niggas who don't know we all the same nigga are the niggas who can't speak nigga bilingually. And that's a damn shame, because if all of us who the same nigga spoke the same nigga language, we wouldn't have to be the nigga somebody made us to be. We could be our own nigga, a new nigga who's one nigga, living the same nigga urban reality. And then and only then can niggas who think they ain't niggas at all and don't want nothing at all to do with nigga music, nigga poetry, and niggas period, well, until they learn bilingual nigga, they can't even have conversations with niggas about no longer being niggas or perpetuating that word. Nigga, you be having these kinds of conversations. You be sharing cigarette butts outside the Martin Beck, discussing Chekhov's first act with Dr. West in a Russian vernacular, and still, ain't nobody paying admission to hear your dreams on open mic night. Of that great getting up morning when you might could maybe with the help of Jesus just get across the Manhattan Bridge, be canonized tragically on Gray Jones' place. Yet you be dreaming of record deals and winning poetry slams. Warning, the slam judges don't know the difference between a sestina and a simile. Warning, this may be hazardous to your health. Warning, your heroes never did this to themselves. Warning, some of your heroes are drunk and vomiting in the alleyways, shooting smack and counting the metaphors on the page like rosary beads, holding Fatinia track from purple lips and vodka spittle. Warning, Broadway's only interested in you posthumously. Warning, publishers aren't buying books about nothing but your tragedy. Warning, the record companies want to buy you and your publishing rights with free Hilfiger gear for the poem your father died for. Want to mix it to machine drum samples that drown out the verse. Want uninformed theory about revolution. Want to edit all terse language that may offend the money people. Want to dress you in spandex, put a Glock and a blunt in your hand, and stand you under a Philip Morris sign at a bar mitzvah bash. They want your black ass, not your black art. And you be dreaming of dying naked in Andy Warhol's arms. Huckabucket, the ghosts are huckabucket. Round your bed at night, huckabucket. The ghosts are huckabucket round your bed at night. All I wanted was to be what Kane said I was the night the Nazi nepotism convention was held to hear the music in my convulsions. All I requested was some say in this matter. Kane asked me to be Abel. Kane asked me to be Able. Somebody said gospel is dead. Hell no, won't be no, won't be no. Hell no, won't be no, won't be no. Black male show, show in the day. Hell no, won't be no, won't be no show. Hell no, won't be no show, no show, not today. Hell no, won't be no, no black male show. Hell no, won't be no show, no show, no, not today. Hell no, hell no, won't be no show, no, no show, not today. Hell no, won't be no show, not today.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones. I'm here with
Caroline Gumperutz.
Thank you so much for allowing me to share your space.
Thank you for being in my space.
I sort of like to start in the beginning. I understand that you were born in Harlem.
I was born in Harlem, 129th Street between Madison and 5th, a third-generation Harlemite. I went to the genealogy thing.
Ancestry.
Ancestry.com, right, exactly. Okay. So I have census records from my great-grandparents living there, I think in the census of 1920, in that same apartment. And I was born in that same apartment. So those Ruxes were there from the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and then the 70s, and then that was it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Based on what I've read, I understood that you grew up in the foster care system.
I did. So when I was born in Harlem, my mother was paranoid schizophrenic, diagnosed, had been before I was born. I had an older brother who was 11 years older than me. And so she was in and out of institutional care before I was born. So she never raised any of her children. So when I was born, I was raised immediately by my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, and I lived with her until I was 4. And then my grandmother died when I was 4. And then I went into foster care. And I was in foster care off and on mostly until I was about 15, and I was adopted by my grandmother's brother and his wife.
Oh.
So my grandmother's brother, James Rux, was born in 1915, and his wife was born in 1923, also in Harlem.
Wow.
And they never had children of their own, and they adopted me. Obviously, there were generations between us, but that was interesting, and it was kind of great. And I lived with them until I went to college and moved out and became a man, and they transitioned.
I understood that living with them also exposed you to some great music.
Oh, my God. Well, that's the greatest thing about being raised by people who are generations older and who had been born in Harlem. You know, I mean, a man who had been born in Harlem basically during World War I and a woman who was born in Harlem during the Renaissance. You don't contextualize it that way when you're young and when they're talking about the years when you think of it. When you get older and you learn about research, you realize, my God, this is what the world was when these people were born and what they'd come through. And he fought in World War II, and she was a dancer in Harlem. And
what did he do?
He, after he came back from the war, he found work in the fur district as a fur cutter for a Jewish man, a business that he eventually bought. So he actually became one of the, if not the first, one of the first black furriers in the fur district. He worked from, I would say, probably 1946. Mm-hmm. He was in the union as a fur cutter and worked there well into his retirement when he was in the 70s. Kind of a funny story about that I love that he tells.
And what is that?
Well, it's great. The business had been around for a while. It was an older Jewish man who had this business, and my father comes around, teaches him, because he didn't know anything about that, cutting fur skins. And then as the years went by, the 50s and the 60s started to come in, and the demand for fur changes, or at least the people who were buying fur coats. There's a point where, the way that my father describes it, well, everybody had a fur. You know, fur wasn't even really a class thing. Let's say in the 40s, I don't mean everybody. Obviously, poor people didn't. But, you know, you could be black and middle class or lower middle class and have a fur, you know, whatever, you know, that kind of thing. So, and there was a standard kind of fur coat, women mostly. So the 40s and the 50s, it was a certain era of fur. By the 60s and 70s, things started to change. And what also really started to change was the area, the 30s, that fur district, 7th Avenue, 8th Avenue, 9th Avenue, 10th Avenue, New York City starts to get a little dodgy, you know, as we know, late 60s, 80s,
right.
70s, you know, so you got your pimps and your bros, you know, everybody's
right.
hanging out.
And
right. So, yeah, things have changed.
Right.
So, let's say wealthy women who were buying their furs wouldn't necessarily go over there to buy their furs. You know, the fur district was in a little bit of trouble. It wasn't having its heyday.
Right.
And his boss who's like, what am I going to do? You know, Jimmy, the business is not what it was. I'm not getting the, you know, the wealthy women coming from right. the Upper East Side to buy the first.
Who have probably moved to Staten Island.
At that point, right. Yeah. Exactly. Neighborhoods are shifting. Right. A lot of things are changing. Yeah. My father has told me that he had this idea coming home one night on his way to Harlem, getting on the train, I think walking from 30th Street over to 42nd Street, seeing all the, again, the heyday of the pimps and the, you know, the miniskirts and the platform. And, you know, he's seeing these brothers out there, and they're mixing it up.
They got fur.
They got fur. but fur like you've never seen. Chinchilla mixed with mink, mixed with, you know, fur boots, fur hats, fur miniskirts, you know, because this was, you know. So he's like, well, the market is changing. So he went back and said that he told his boss, he said, look, there's a market. You know, there's people out here buying fur. There's somebody with, you know, it may not be the people that you that used to come in here,
right.
but money is money, and money is green. So it was like, we need to change the styles of the furs,
right.
and we need to stop being concerned about, you know, who we're marketing to,
wow.
you know, whatever. And so he started to come up with some designs that were a little more funky,
okay.
a little more soulful, you know,
wow.
something James Brown might wear, or, you know,
right,
that
right.
whole, you know, that you've seen those pictures.
Sure, of course.
You
yeah,
know,
I saw Superfly.
Exactly. You saw Superfly, the hats with a little
yeah.
dip down over one eye kind of
yeah.
hat and all that. And they got a very colorful crowd, you know,
wow.
And the business started to boom again, and
wow.
the man was grateful. And then, and around this time, the man was getting older and tired of the business and sold it to my father. He said, you've done such a great thing for me, and, you know, you really picked the business up. So it's a funny story, but
yeah.
it's a great story.
It
I love that.
Story.
I love that story. Yeah. So he
found his niche.
He found his niche. He's like, you know.
So did he wind up doing that business until he died?
No, he did until he retired. He retired. He didn't stay in it long. Because by the 70s, of course, he's like 60 years old, 65. He's
okay.
getting older. You know, no, he retired in the mid to late 70s.
Okay.
And stayed home until he died at the age of 83.
Okay, wow. When did you leave Harlem?
At the age of 4,
okay.
when my grandmother died, because I had to. Grandmother loves candy, blue candy. Boy shares blue candy with grandmother. Blue candy. Boy is 4. Boy is 4 and unkempt. Grandmother is fat. Grandmother is fat and unkempt. The apartment is a railroad. Unkempt railroad. Boy has candy, blue candy. Boy has candy, blue candy. Boy's tongue blue, grandmother's lips blue. Blue lips are open, blue tongue is sleeping. Grandmother is blue. Grandmother, grandmother is blue and asleep. Grandmother, you make accident. You make accident on yourself. You make accident on yourself. Grandmother is sleeping. Grandmother is sleeping. Miss Lady from Hallway plays with grandmother sometimes. Grandmother and Miss Lady from Hallway play with cards and bottle and brown bag. Miss Lady from Hallway knocks on door. Miss Lady from Hallway got bottle and brown bag and cards. Miss Lady Hallway comes to play with grandmother. Door is locked. Boy talks to Miss Lady from behind locked door. Grandmother has candy. Blue candy. Grandmother is asleep. Grandmother is asleep in blue. Grandmother is asleep in blue. Blue candy. Grandmother is asleep in blue. Blue men with shiny buttons and red lights make noise outside window. Blue men with shiny buttons bang on locked door. Blue men break locked door open.
Blue men with shiny buttons open broken door. Blue men in door look like blue men on TV. Dragon net. Grandmother is asleep. Blue men from TV with shiny buttons break door open. Poke and push blue grandmother. Grandmother is blue and stinks. Blue men give naked boy a t-shirt and marbles with different colors on tin board. Marbles make star on board. The apartment is a railroad. A railroad that stinks. Red lights outside windows break off walls. Red lights outside window break on and off. Red lights outside come inside windows and blink on walls on and off. Everything inside red railroad is red. Everything inside blue railroad is red. Blue men all turn red. Grandmother must be cold, blue cold. Red and blue men cover grandmother with dirty pink sheet. Blue men cover grandmother with dirty pink sheet from bed. Grandmother make accident on bed. Accident on pink sheet. Grandmother is covered in dirty pink sheet. Grandmother's feet are showing. Miss Lady Hallway is crying. Blue men with shiny buttons talk loud. Miss Lady Hallway talks loud. Grandmother! Grandmother is asleep. Grandmother is asleep in blue. Grandmother is asleep in blue. Blue. Cold blue sleep. Cold. Bangs and curls. Black bangs and curls sits next to boy. There's a man in green hat who stands next to black bangs and curls. Black bangs and curls smells nice. Green hat man says nothing. Black bangs and curls, is that your name? Boy asks. My name is Arsula. That's a funny name. I got blue candy, Arsula. Grandmother loves blue candy. Grandmother's asleep in blue. I got blue candy, Arsula. Would you like some blue candy, Arsula? No more blue candy for you. No more blue candy for Arsula. Black Bangs and Curls says, would you like to come home with me, boy? Would you like to come home with me, boy? Everything is red inside railroad. Everything is red inside blue railroad. Red lights blink on walls on and off. Red lights blink on walls on and off. Grandmother is asleep in blue. Grandmother is asleep in blue. I was only wanting things I couldn't have. I was only three. I was only a blank page. I was only a blank page without writing. I was only sand without footprints. I never should have, should have, should have, should have, should have, should have. Never could have, never could have, never would have, never would have, never would have, never would have. Case number 2674-B. When was the last time you? When was the last time you had a meal? Do you know who you are? Do you know who you are? Do you know who your father is? Get out of my
Red River Mutch.
My house, my house, my house, my house, Peter's my house.
Brick and mortar. Mountain skates. Square and shark. Jack and shake.
Case number 3674-B. When was the last time you, when was the last time you had a meal? Do you know who you are? Do you know who you are? Please remove your clothes.
There was some tragedy. I mean, basically, I was born into a typical African-American, East Harlem family. You know, at that time, the community was ravaged by crime, by drugs, by heroin, by alcohol, high infant mortality rates, anything you can imagine that might have been happening to Harlem post-World War II certainly affected my family firsthand. And my grandmother was an alcoholic and died of acute alcoholism when I was 4 years old. So I remember the police, I remember the social workers, the agencies, the, you know, all that stuff, and, you know, just being sort of rescued, taking out. I was the last child that she had raised, because she had raised my brother, my cousins. My maternal grandmother had two daughters.
Okay.
One was paranoid schizophrenic, as I mentioned.
Right.
Her other daughter had several children, and she also had several abortions and died of a bad abortion, back alley kind of abortion.
Mm.
So basically, the onus was on my grandmother and her sisters and brothers and people, wherever, to raise, you know, all these children,
right,
you know, the children of these daughters. And my grandmother's brother and his wife, who would eventually adopt me, had left Harlem in the early 60s, kicking and screaming, you know, as he said, because, you know, they were born and raised in Harlem. They were Harlemites and loved Harlem.
Right.
But, you know, by 1962, Harlem had seen, they had seen personally, at least three or four riots, the 30s, the 40s, you know, the 50s, you know, all these riots, these things that had happened. Sure. Harlem wasn't Harlem anymore. The jazz age of Harlem, which they embraced so, that's how they met. They met in the jazz club, mm-hmm. you know. They went out and hung out in jazz clubs. Right.
It was different, though. I mean, in the 60s, there was the Black Arts Movement still.
But those people were younger than right. them. Right. And it was, so there was a bit of a generational difference.
Right.
So it's almost like, you're right, they weren't too old to hang out with mm-hmm. the Black Arts Movement, but I kind of think that it was sort of like
it was a generational difference.
And I love that discourse. I love that conversation between my parents. He actually, I think, had an affinity. He had a broader appreciation of the progression of jazz mm-hmm. and its evolution. Mm-hmm. She, however, had a stopping point.
Right.
My father could get into Bitches Brew.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, let me put it this way. Some of the greatest conversations I've ever heard them have used to be around Betty Carter.
Mm.
And my mother was finished with Betty Carter when Betty Carter began to abstract the melody.
Mm.
My father loved her all the way.
Yeah.
And they used to argue about, so my father would still bring home records right. of Betty and that, you know, when she started to get a little more experimental.
So when Betty Carter was no longer Bebop Betty.
Exactly. My mother was like a Bebop girl.
Right,
my mother
right.
was like Bebop, Die Hard, and,
right.
you know, she was like, oh, I need a Dizzy Gillespie. That was her, you know. And she loved jazz. But when Coltrane started to experiment, right. when Miles started to, though she did appreciate some of what Miles was doing, but she had some reservations, you know. She had a problem with where there was this thing that was happening in the 60s
right.
with jazz and how it began to change and it became a little more abstract. She still returned to her Dizzy.
Mm-hmm.
She still returned to Billy.
Uh-huh.
She still returned to Lester Young.
Right.
Nat King Cole. What's his name? There I go, there I go, there I go. What's his name?
James Moody.
Yes, James Moody and all that. That was her. And then she did something I think very interesting, which is because she hated Motown,
mm-hmm.
she was not an appreciator of this. She thought that was bubblegum.
Okay.
But of course, she's
what
a woman in her...
Bubblegum?
Right. It wasn't for her. She's
right,
a woman
right.
in her 40s at that point,
right.
you know, and she didn't care about any of that. So she skipped what was happening musically, the Motown era,
mm-hmm.
but however, began to appreciate soul music,
mm.
which I find very interesting. She really fell in love with Marvin Gaye, you know,
okay.
What's Going On.
Okay.
She picked up with him around that time.
Okay.
Like by the time he did that, she was like, okay, baby, you got me.
Right.
You know, Me and Mrs. Jones,
okay.
you know, all that stuff. You know,
she liked Philadelphia International.
Exactly. Gladys Knight.
Motown.
Exactly.
Okay.
She got, yeah. Gambling Huff. Yeah.
I was thinking she was more, you said soul, I was thinking Stax. Which is probably a little too country for her.
It might have been a little too country, except she was a dancer and she did like a beat. But
okay.
I don't think she got into it hot and heavy.
Okay.
She was a lover and an appreciator of black culture.
Mm-hmm.
So she never badmouthed mm-hmm. what was happening with black music. And then something happened, I guess, in black music where she felt an invitation.
Well, could it be the message?
I think certainly was a message,
yeah.
because we're talking close to war, right?
Vietnam
era,
yeah.
right? It was also, if you listen to style-wise, I mean, what Marvin Gaye did with What's Going On was very different from anything he'd done with Motown,
right.
and it almost harks back to a jazz phraseology,
definitely.
Right?
Definitely.
The same is true for Billy Paul and all that, you know, that kind of jazzy,
right.
and, East, I remember she loved that, Wind Going East, Billy Paul used to sing that, you know that song?
WBAI, New York.
No love, no peace, no shoes on my feet, no home, just a shack where I sleep. Take me back to my life with no shoes. Oh, when blowing east, I'm the cry of a slave. Wind blowing east, carry tears
and never, never, never no peace.
Just this melodic, you know, yes, so I think it was message, and it was a clean way of singing, and it wasn't bubblegum pop,
right.
Teenager.
Right.
You know, there was a depth to it. She could relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, she returned to the music. I have to tell you, I think I was raised by two of the most remarkable people on the planet, because, mm-hmm. especially musically.
So for you, how did you wind up first writing? When did the bug bite?
The bug bit me the moment that I could put pencil to paper. And I think because I grew up in foster care, because I'd come from disenfranchised circumstances, because there was things like alcohol and drugs and, you know, all these other things that were affecting the black community at the time that I was born had affected me, and because I was in foster care, and because I did not have an idea of what family was, at least traditional family structures were, I needed to talk to somebody, because I think at that time, the way children were taken care of, in foster care especially, they were taken care of with food, clothes, and shelter.
Right.
But no one ever asked you or me how I felt.
Mm-hmm. They were taken care of, but they weren't nourished.
Exactly.
Or nurtured.
Exactly. Oh. Exactly. And there was no sort of psychiatric care offered or psychological care.
There was no processing.
No processing of, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I became very interested in books, and I guess it makes sense. I mean, like any child of the storm, you find a story, you find a book, you find a movie, you find some fantasy that you sort of hide yourself in, and you invent a world. And that was what I did. And then my adoptive mother, she...
Have we said her name yet?
Her name was Ursula Rutz.
Okay.
Yeah, was, like I said, very literate and loved books, and so always encouraged me to read and listen to music, as you can see, and to talk about music and culture and world events. And, you know, she was just an avid radio listener, not a big TV watcher, but she did like PBS and things like that. Loved books, loved poetry, loved novels. She used to draw a little bit. She loved the arts. She would take me to museums. All these things were very important to her.
Mm-hmm.
And so since she'd not had a child of her own and was a middle-aged woman who had adopted the child, she, I think, made sure that she did everything she had intended to do for the next generation with me, which was to take me to all the places that she'd always wanted to take the child to.
Right.
You know, very, very important.
Excellent.
She stressed it. And
excellent.
So, yeah.
Wow, you seem to have gotten a lot more culturally from her. I mean, you had the exposure from your father of more experimental types of, quote, jazz.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as just well-rounded everything, you seem to have gotten a lot of it from your mother.
I credit her with a lot of it, absolutely. I think she was very clear that culture was going to save my life.
Yeah.
And I think that she made sure that she had some part in that.
So how old were you when you got this voice?
Oh, my God. That's the other crazy, I'm always asked that question, but that's the other crazy thing. Well, because I don't know who my biological father is, and I'm assuming I might have got it from him, so my voice started to change when I was 11, and I remember that, but like most kids' voice starts to change, but mine seemed to go from A to Z, you know, like it just had this leap. Exactly. And I remember being made fun of a lot. Mm. I remember, like, first day of class, you know, when the teacher would ask kids, like, what's your name?
Right.
And everybody would say their name, you know, but when it got around to me, you'd hear this kind of voice. It was just a little too deep for a 12-year-old or 11-year-old.
Yeah.
The kids would always cackle, and I would always be a little embarrassed or whatever. But it was always a deep voice. And then people always imagined that I was older than I was, or bigger in stature than I was, or, you know, because, you know, when you think about the bass baritone African-American male,
right.
You think about Paul Robeson, you
yes.
think about Barry White.
Yes.
I don't look like that.
Right.
And that's always been sort of the stereotypical idea in people's minds of the, even the guy on the insurance commercial, you know, the Allstate.
Oh, yes, yes.
You know, but I don't look like those men, you know,
right.
I mean, I was always just an average-sized guy, and,
right.
you know, so you'd hear this big booming voice coming out of this little guy, or, you know, average height, and, you know, not necessarily dark or fat, or, you know,
right.
just, I'm just me, you know.
Right, right. Well,
and again, it's a stereotype of
right.
what goes with the voice. So,
sure. So once you accepted it, that, you know, this is my voice, I'm stuck with it, when did you decide to embrace it and, like, sing or act or something?
I was told to embrace it. I was taught
oh,
okay. to embrace it.
Okay.
And I'll tell you who was the first person to teach me to embrace my voice.
Okay.
Was Robert Earl Jones, James Earl Jones's father.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to my junior high school to talk to the kids. I don't know why or what the circumstance was. We got to ask him questions. We didn't know who he was. But,
right.
you know, and I remember that he heard me speak. And he had a very deep voice,
mm-hmm.
of course, just like his son.
Sure.
You know. So he hears this little boy with this deep voice. I must have recognized something in himself.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I guess I was well-spoken.
Mm-hmm.
I remember him saying that.
You were articulate.
I seemed to be articulate
yeah.
for an 11-year-old.
Right. Wow.
And so he suggested that I join the Harlem Boys Choir. He asked me whether or not I could sing, and I didn't know because I'd never sung. And then he got me an audition with Arthur Turnbull and Harlem Boys Choir,
mm-hmm.
and I sang. So I joined the Harlem Boys Choir,
mm-hmm.
and I'm in the baritone section.
Right.
And then I learned that, well, I guess that was the first time that I learned that there was anything called a baritone. I mean, I had no word for
sure.
what a deep voice, well, just deep voice.
Right, right.
Old deep voice Carl, that's all
right.
I ever got, you know. You know, frog voice Carl, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then, yeah, but now I am a baritone, and this is an art, this is a
right.
thing,
right.
to be studied. And there are tenors, and there are baritones, and there are basses, and you
right.
are legitimate.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So, whatever, second tenors and blah, 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 you know.
Right.
And what you can sing, the tenors cannot,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so then when I knew that I could do something that others could not do,
mm-hmm.
and that part could be written for in music,
right.
and that it was beautiful, and that it was legitimate, and that it was needed, and,
right.
and that it was necessary, I started to embrace it and feel good about myself, and it was a wonderful thing. And then, of course, to sing spirituals, and that was the first time I was exposed to Paul Robeson's voice,
mm-hmm.
you know, listening to those records and hearing spirituals and hearing that era. They always wanted the deep voice. The baritone to sing things like this, you know,
right.
whatever. So, like, it was great. I felt like a star. I was like, oh, okay, I'm somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was fun. Not just a freak,
sure,
you know,
sure.
and that was very good. And then Robert Earl Jones also encouraged me to not just sing, but he wanted me to act. He was trying to start like a children's theater company.
Mm.
That never really got off the ground, but he started in the basement of a church in Harlem. I can't remember which church it was. I do remember that I would go to the Harlem Boys Choir. At that time, we were rehearsing on 155th Street, and then I would leave there, and then I would go for this other after-school thing with Robert Earl Jones, and he had, like, a few other kids, and he would try to teach us about plays.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it was Langston Hughes plays or poems and things like that, and
right.
we'd read it, you know, because he was part of Langston Hughes' Suitcase Theater Company.
Oh, okay.
And so he would teach us to recite poetry,
mm-hmm.
teach us what poetry would mean. Then I went to high school, because I went to performing arts, LaGuardia, and I maintained a relationship with him often. On, as well as with the boys choir, sang in the gospel choir, and so that became interesting. And
so that explains a lot of your music, how it sounds like you're a preacher.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was the influence of the spirituals and then gospel, and then at home I'm listening to jazz, and on the street I'm listening to hip-hop, and, you know, and instead of having a nervous breakdown, I was just saying somehow all of this was coming together, you know.
And a woman comes down with songs and hand claps. She's dressed in velvet and lace, satin scarf on her head, powder on her lips, pondering her face in the subway child. While the train reaches heaven, the young black man turns to the old man and he looks at the woman who sings out loud to herself. She sings out loud to herself.
11 more days in the city.
One kid says to the other, son, it's time, it's drawing nigh. Armageddon be here soon. African man just then with copper and brown walks up to the scoop, thinks maybe soon he'll make enough money to get back to Abidjan. One boy opens the door, others pull smoke screen. The three of them just stand there, looking at each other. And the madman from Africa says, oh,
7 more days in the city.
Somewhere on lockdown now. This girl, she takes pictures of herself naked and sends them with cigarettes in the mail. And sometimes he puts a hand to his thigh, his eyes locked in the shower, says, can you say that you love?
And this is oratory, you know, aspect of it. And then theater, you know, again, the importance of the voice in theater, because Robert Earl Jones was, like I said, he worked in Langston Hughes' Suitcase Theater Company with Gertrude Jeanette, who was a theater director, an actor.
Why don't you tell us about the Langston Hughes Suitcase Theater
Company? Langston Hughes started the theater company in Harlem on 125th and St. Nicholas, and it was upstairs. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, in the mid to late 50s, because at this time, a lot of black actors weren't finding work, mm-hmm. Even in theater, because theater had its sort of Harlem heyday, mm-hmm. 20s, 30s, 40s, Lafayette Theater and all that. Mm-hmm. Then there was then you have the war, then there seems to be no theater, you know. Langston Hughes is like, you know, where is black theater? What is happening with black theater? This is pre-Lorraine Hansberry. And so he starts this suitcase theater company in this loft and invites black actors to come and to express themselves. So, and it's also is an outlet for a lot of these people who were actors and have been performers and actors for 20, 30 years, who if they could find work acting, again, it was always, you know, as somebody's maid, as somebody's butler, but nothing deeper than that. And so it was all about validity. It was all about substance and us being able to talk about us and for us and to us. And so Langston Hughes starts a theater company. Gertrude Jeanette was a member. Like I said, Robert L. Jones was a member and many other people. And around that time, you start to have some things happen. You know, James Earl Jones is becoming a young actor at this time, and off-Broadway theater is burgeoning. Off-Broadway is itself beginning to exist in America and in New York City, whether it's black theater or not. So there's an outlet for black actors. Cicely Tyson is finding a way. Ruby Dee, post-war, is finding places, you know, to create theater, to do work. So the 50s becomes sort of a very interesting kind of era that I think people don't talk about as much as they do about sort of the Harlem Renaissance of the 60s, but this little window, this pre-Raisin in the Sun era, but post-Lafayette Theater, you know, thing that's starting to happen. And that I think is very important, you know. And
maybe you're right about it.
Yes, absolutely. Because we're always finding a way, being creative, and saying, look, if we have to make a play in somebody's living room, let's make a play, you know, because we still have something to talk about and something to do.
Exactly.
And this, of course, leads into, you know, what we now call and identify as the Black Arts Movement, and Amiri Baraka, and Ed Bullins, and Sonia Sanchez, and on and on and on.
You Jane know. Cortez.
Jane Cortez, God bless her. Exactly. You know, and saying, let's do it, let's get it done. You know, the new Lafayette Theater, you know, and all this stuff. And then you have a whole other resurgence at NEC, you know, Negro Ensemble Company. And people start to get recognized. So Robert L. Jones is sort of, and Gertrude Jeanette, I mean, these people, that was the time. That was the period. That was
and you worked with them.
I did. I did Raisin in the Sun, because Miss Jeanette, which is what we had called her, of course, Miss Jeanette.
Sure.
Had the Hadley Players on 135th Street in Harlem in the church. And she had understudied on Broadway in Raisin in the Sun, had been in Tennessee Williams plays as well on Broadway. You know, even in the Blaxploitation era, you know, was in Shaft and things like that. She was very serious about theater and acting. And
well, there were a lot of actors and actresses that were serious about theater who were in those films.
That's right. That's right.
That was the work at the time.
That's right. And, oh, and she was no joke. Miss Jeanette was, you showed up on time, you learned your lines, you know. As my favorite line from Miss Jeanette is, you know, this is not amateur theater. She would, I didn't care where, you know, if we're in my kitchen doing something, this is not amateur theater. So she was a taskmaster, and she was great.
Yeah.
And so she directed a production of Raisin in the Sun. I played George Murchison. I think I was 18 or something, you know, just to learn the stage and to understand what the stage meant. And that was just very important to me. What a gift. The more I think about it and the more I think about the interconnectedness, I mean, these things were just happening in my life. And I don't know that I was at the time, I certainly was appreciative, but I don't know that I was completely aware of what was happening, that the community, no matter how ravaged it had been by war, the economy, the crisis of just being a Negro intellectual or not, or just being a Negro, by all of it, there were always teachers, elders, artists, parents who were around and interested in giving me something to take with me for the rest of my life. And I'm eternally grateful to those elders, and I always will be.
Way back when I was being me, being me. Way back when I there were shackles on the mind. There were shackles, there were shackles, there were shackles.
hate talking over this because this is a cut from Homeostasis, Carl Hancock Ruck's Homeostasis, which you'll be able to get if you go to the Apollo on the 19th and the 20th of April and catch Carl Hancock Ruck's there. Pick up your CD, hear this song without my babbling. But I have to tell you what you heard, and that's one of the difficult things about having a spoken word person on. You don't want to talk over this stuff. But here we go. Like I said, what you're listening to now is Shackles from Homeostasis, released this next week. Before that, we heard 11 More Days from Apothecary RX. Before that, we heard East by Billy Paul. Before that, we heard Asphalt Yards. The soloist on the keyboardist, the soloist was Rick Mandel, because I enjoyed that a lot. And that's from Ruck's Review. Also, Blue Candy, which was played before that, was from Ruck's Review. No Blackmail Show, also from Ruck's Review. And we opened up the show with Nina Simone and her version of I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl. And thank you, David Kenny, for ending with Nina Simone. Stay tuned for more Sugar My Bowl, Carl Hancock Ruck's on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. And WBAI.org on the web.
Your first, I guess, I don't know, your first book was Elmina Blues?
It was the chapbook, yes.
It was a chapbook, okay.
Yeah, I decided that I needed to get out of America. This is after high school, going to college. But now the elders had created a monster. I guess when I say they created a monster, the thing is that I guess around the age of 18, 19, you know, I mean, I'm reading the autobiography of Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. I'm reading all of Maya Angelou's memoirs and, you know, as much Baldwin as I could read and all these things. And I remember, and this may say, I laugh at it because it seems silly to me, but it's not silly, but it was interesting. I found sort of a through line between these people, James Baldwin, Maya Angelou, Malcolm X, and other artists, they all somehow seem to make their way to Paris and make their way to Ghana.
Uh-huh.
So, not for the same reasons. I don't know why Ghana and Paris was so important, but I knew that every time I picked up a book, somebody was speaking French or they had gone to Africa, you know.
Right.
So I figured, you know, I'm this 19-year-old, starry-eyed, whatever. I'm like, well, all right. If I do anything in life, I've got to get to Paris and I've got to get to Ghana.
Did you learn French?
I did a little bit. I mean, at the time I spoke just enough to get around, but I was never really fluent. I'm really bad now.
Okay.
I'd had my little high school French.
Okay.
And then what I could learn conversationally. Went to the American University of Paris.
Okay.
So that was the first time I'd been anywhere because I'd never left New York.
Right.
And then...
what did you get from having gone there?
To Paris?
Yeah.
One of the things I got was a sense of history. It was the beginning of something that I still do to this day. When I packed to go, I had a loose-leaf notebook. And in my loose-leaf notebook, I wrote down all the addresses that I could find in all the books that I had read of where African-American people had lived or had been in Paris.
Mm.
From the 20s all the way through, anywhere. I wanted to know where did Baldwin live?
Right.
Where did Langston live?
Right.
What jazz club did they go to?
Right.
Where was Josephine Baker's club? Where was her apartment? I just needed to see these places.
Sure, sure.
That there was a black history in a European city. I mean, it was fascinating to me. Went to every single address that I could find. I still have that book. I wouldn't say that Paris, that trip, changed my... Well, of course it changed my life, but it didn't have as a profound effect on me as going to Ghana did. Because after that, I went to the University of Ghana at Legon, and I really wrote poetry, and that's when I wrote Elmina Blues.
Okay.
You know, so many things, events happened in Ghana, and just being there, and in Nigeria, and in Cote d'Ivoire, in the Ivory Coast, and in Togo, you know, that really gave me a feeling. I just had something changed. You know, life began to turn. Life began to change. You know, I wasn't searching for something that was no more. I was searching for something that was and had always been. And there it was. And so that really was profound.
Who is Elmina?
Elmina is the name of the castle, the Portuguese castle in Ghana, which means place of the mind. And Elmina Blues, I met, he's still there. There's an African-American man and woman who live near that castle who still give tours of it to African-American tourists. And they gave me a tour of the castle and showed me where Africans had been enslaved.
Okay.
And, you know, the door of no return.
Right, right.
And there's the vast ocean before you and all this. And there's that beach and all that stuff. And I stayed with them. And I was taught that history. It was very ritualistic.
Mm-hmm.
And I was taken to that castle. And that's when I wrote that Elmina Blues poem. It was about that history and about my being there and about that land, that legacy, and that connectedness.
And later on, Rough Review, your first release as a recording artist, I guess, you have Elmina Blues Opus.
Right.
Yeah.
It took away the drum. They took away the drum. So I use my voice, for Guinea. Listen. And red and baby blue pale, terrain of obscurity, smooth face, inviting earth, quick and quiver of cheek and lip.
person. Rising brow. Hands. Marauding. Dusky earth. Wedged between fingers. Fingers touching. Land. Inviting earth. Hands.
Came back to New York doing that as a poem at the New York and wherever I could do poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So people knew me for it. So then years later, when I made a record, I knew that it had to be on there and created music and did it as a song on the first record.
Right. Yeah. Now, before I skip to the music, there is the whole New Yorican period.
Mm-hmm.
What was the transition from writing and Ghana and France?
The transition was to getting to the New Yorican was theater. The first thing I did artistically as a professional was theater. I wrote a play.
Mm-hmm.
because I had a brother die. My older brother died, and I wrote a play called Song of Sacred Men that Isaiah Washington was in and a few other actors.
What's your brother's name?
My brother was Ralph Hancock. The play was produced on 44th Street, Manhattan Theater District, and at the National Black Arts Festival and, you know, National Black Theater Festival, a few other places or whatever. So that was, it was called Song of Sad Young Men. And then after that play, and I was hanging out at the time with a bunch of friends who were young actors who had just graduated from Howard University, and we all wanted to change the world. And so they were all mostly in my plays, and we were doing things. And then I decided to do a more poetic play, and I was invited to the university in New York to read from my work or to be on a panel and talk about theater or what I was doing. I was really young, 20. And Luis Reyes Rivera, the poet, was on that panel. And I met Luis Reyes Rivera.
Yeah.
And he heard me read El Mita Blues.
Okay.
And then he loved what I did and said, you need to go down to the New Yorker Poets Cafe on 3rd Street between B and C. Meet me there. You're doing good stuff. You need to be over there. I'd never heard of it and didn't know anything about it, so I hopped on the train and went down the Lower East Side and went over there, and then there were all these poets, and there was Dale Landa Smith and everybody else and all these, you know, people doing poetry, and, and Miguel Athedin, and, you know, and then Zaki Shange would come through, and, you know, just everybody, and Jane Cortez, you know, all these greats that I was meeting, and I fell in love, and Luis Reyes Rivera talked to Miguel Athedin about me, and in the very informal, typical fashion that was Miguel, you know, he said, you know, hey, well, but do whatever you do here. I gave me a weekend, and my friends, we got together, and we just started doing, you know, our little poetry and plays, you know, there at the New Yorker on a weekend, and, you know, we went up there and just started to sing and recite and, you know, just do a little something. Man, how I did that, I will never know, but I mean, then I was there every day.
Wow.
I wouldn't leave.
Wow.
You couldn't get me out of there.
I mean, but you were singing at that point.
Well, singing poetry. Yeah, that was the one thing I was doing. The way that I was reciting poetry was the first time I got up to recite poetry, because I'd heard everybody else, and I thought to myself, and it had that competitive environment, and so then they were like, you know, hey, Rux, why don't you read? And I'm 20, and I'm thinking, oh my God, am I good enough? Is it going to, I don't know what's going to happen. So the first thing I did was the El Mita Blues poem, and because the El Mita Blues poem was written as a chant, it was the first thing I did. So the first time I got up in front of a crowd at the New Yorker to read a poem, I was singing, speaking, you know, and the audience loved it, and, you know, and really got into it. And then that became, it always became part of what I was doing. I always found some way to use my voice, not to be a singer so much, but to not just find the words on the page, but to find a melodic structure for the words on the page, and to find out what it meant to my voice when I stood up. And somehow that became important. I guess it became significant. And I wasn't the only one. You know, I mean, Tracy Morris, she was doing that with hip-hop. I mean, she was doing that with her sort of a scat hip-hop kind of thing. I was doing it more of a chanty, gospel, West African-influenced kind of way, jazz kind of way, you know. But there weren't many of us at that time who were sort of sing-speaking. And that was what I sort of accidentally created for myself, the persona that I created for myself as a stand-up poet at the New Yorker.
So did that pretty much open up all the roads at that point?
It opened up a lot of roads, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did. I mean, theater did as well. I mean, the play before I was at the New Yorker had been reviewed and been written about and all that stuff.
Sure.
So, but then the New Yorker fine-tuned me, you know, I think, because Miguel Athedin and all those great writers coming through, black, white, Latino, whoever, here in literature, writers of different generations, fine-tuned me, then hosting the radio show, because I hosted the radio show at the New Yorker, which was on the AI.
Live at the New Yorker.
Exactly, live at the New Yorker.
Was Matthew Finch the arts director at the time?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So for, I don't remember how many years, maybe 3 or 4 years, but I hosted the radio show live from the New Yorker. I took over from Miguel, and he asked me to.
Wow. You have any of that?
I don't have those tapes. I wish I did. I physically don't have it, and I wish I did. I did have a cassette once of something.
Okay.
I don't know where that cassette tape is now, but I had some great people on the show. I mean, I had Gene Lee on that show. I had Toshi Regan on that show. you know, oh, just every, it was so great. I mean, that was a just a college, I mean, for me.
Now, Jean Lee, I found out with, she worked with Horace Tapscott.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Yeah, and unfortunately, she had transitioned by the time I had found out about her.
Oh, my God. She was another person, again, in that fine-tuning with me, because the first time I heard her sing, it was around the time that this album that she recorded had come out in France, mm-hmm. called Natural Affinities, mm-hmm. and that's what she was singing at the time. Mm-hmm. And the first song on that album was Mingus Meditations, mm-hmm. where she was singing the words of Charles Mingus, taken from his autobiography, mm-hmm. and speaking and singing. And I remember hearing her live from Eureka, and, you know, when she said, you know, my music is evidence. And this is all a cappella, by the way. Mm-hmm. You know, my music is evidence of my soul's will to live, my metathesis, and then she would start singing, eternal souls, muse in case man.
My music is evidence of my soul's will to live beyond my sperm's grave. My metathesis, or eternal souls, new encasement.
Vibrato. I had never heard anything like that. Mm-hmm. That blew my mind. Yeah. I was like, you know, by the way, this all harkens back to when I think about my parents. Yeah, and I have to say this, you know, as excited as I am with you right now, this is how my mother and father used to talk about jazz and about Harlem and about the first time they heard Billy at Amateur Night and Ella Fitzgerald sang. And they were there for all those shows. And they talked about, and they would get very excited. They remember what they wore. They, then they would go and get the records, which they kept,
right.
Like gold.
Pristine.
Pristine. You know, I was not allowed to touch that vinyl, you know, and they would hold them between their palms, uh-huh. and let them down and bring that needle up ever so carefully and put it down, and we'd have to sit back and nobody moved just to,
right.
get to make sure the thing didn't jump or skip.
Right.
You know, don't scratch those records, I would have been put out of the house, I'm telling you. But I now understand that excitement. When I think about the first time I heard someone like Jean Lee,
right.
and what it meant to me and how it revolutionized, to back up a little bit, I came back from Africa going, Ogene, 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 Ogene. Learning the influence, of course, by West Africa and West African chants, you know. They took away the drum. You know, of course, there's a little gospel influence in there, but I'm not relying so heavily on the gospel thing because I was never a great gospel singer, but I had had some training. Like I could hear a pitch, and I was also being lured into a musicology for some reason, though it was not my ambition to be a singer. It was my ambition always to be a writer, but somehow music was always saying, don't forget about me. Now, when I heard Jean Lee, and she's reading this text and singing it without this vibrato, but this jazz, this easiness, and I realized that the words must have a musicality,
mm-hmm.
you know, that there must be space, that there must be silence, and, you know, and that there must be phrasing. All of this comes to the fore in listening to Jean Lee, of course, going back to Abby Lincoln, going back to Billie Holiday, going back to my mother's trying to teach me, you know, all that stuff. It all just kind of coalesced, I guess, in a way. I guess I tried to find ways to borrow from it, mm-hmm. for myself as a poet. And then the more I did it, the more musicians would say, let me back you up, let me do something with you. And then the more that started to happen, I guess the road to the first record was, I was at CBGB's. I had met Soshi Regan. She'd been on the show. We were new friends. She had a concert there. She asked me to come through and read a poem. I did. That night, Nona Hendricks had come. She was a special guest. Nona heard me, liked what I did, asked me whether or not I had ever considered recording. I had said no. Or I didn't even know what that really meant. What we were doing wasn't what was on the radio.
Right.
You know, New Jack Swing was on the radio,
right,
and hip-hop
right.
was on the radio. And I wasn't a rapper, and I wasn't an R&B singer. So the idea of recording music was, you know, far-fetched to me, or that anybody would be interested in me as a recording artist. But Nona Hendricks said she thought that there was some variance in what I was doing, and she wanted to bring me into the studio. And then she brought me into her office and studio, and we started to demo records and write songs together. And then she started to teach me about the studio, and she introduced me to the microphone and to the recording room and to the idea of accompaniment and the idea of production.
Mm-hmm.
And she put the first official band I had together with singers, and she started to book the venues beyond the Nigeria for me to perform at. And then she started to invite record labels.
Wow.
You know, V2 came, and Sony came, and this is also around the time that the poetry thing was blowing up.
Right.
And all these record labels came and whatever, and thus there you have the first record that came out on Sony.
Rough Review.
Rough Review.
Wow. So is that how you met Helga Davis?
No.
Okay.
Helga Davis and I grew up in the same neighborhood and went to the same junior high school. I've known Helga Davis since I was 11 years old. Of course, after junior high school, parted ways. So we only knew each other from 5th grade to 8th grade and were friends. And then we went to different high schools, different colleges. Maybe we saw each other in the summer. I remember at the time that I was going to Columbia, I ran into her on the campus once. We weren't friends, necessarily. I remember always being intimidated by her, and because she was a bully. She was, but you know, she was. She was just a smart, you know, tall, pretty girl. She had no idea that I wrote or anything. I had no idea that she sang. We kept those parts of ourselves. We were kids, you know, about 18 or 19 or something. I remember being on the campus of Columbia and running into her. She says she doesn't remember this. I do remember this. And I remember Helga, she was passing out leaflets for something, or she was with somebody. I don't remember. But I remember that she went off on me about my jeans. She asked me whether I knew how many children in China or something had died in factories making my jeans or something, I forget. Or the shirt I had on. I might have had on an Izod shirt, because by then I'm trying to be preppy, and there's
okay.
all this stuff, you know. Because I'm in Columbia now, you know. I'm got out of Harlem, and I'm just trying to leave a certain world behind. And I remember that in my mind. And so I remember her trying to hit me with some kind of political consciousness and me kind of being like, you know, whatever, and, you know, walking away from her. And then when I had the play years later, she came to that and threw a party for me or something. So we reunited as friends. And then it just all started to find out that she sang. And we're hanging around in the same crowds, and she's hanging with Greg Tate. And then she, you know, joined Women in Love. And then I heard her sing for the first time and was blown away, because I'd never known this girl that I'd known since I was 11 years old could sing like that.
And she's on every recording.
She's on every single album that I've ever made. Exactly. Right. But she's my sister.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like she and Marcel Davies Lashley are like my blood relatives.
Yes.
You know, they are my sisters.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Well, my introduction to Marcel was her tambourine play, actually. Who was she playing with?
Was it Toshi or?
I think it was either Toshi or Imani Azuri.
Uh-huh.
It was one of the two. But then, you know, going back to these recordings, like, oh my gosh, she was singing on there.
Oh, yeah. Well, she was always a singer.
Yeah, yeah.
The tambourine thing, because she also grew up in the black church.
Okay.
And so the tambourine thing comes from that.
Okay.
And her father is from Sierra Leone, and her mother is from Liberia.
Okay.
And she grew up in Fort Greene Projects.
Okay.
And we went to high school together. So we always had this sort of interest in music and culture together. And we'd run to Alvin Ailey shows and play Roberta Flack records and all these things together. And she became my sister, you know, my fast best friend. The tambourine thing, for her, I think, really is because of Bernice Johnson Regan. When we were both cast in Robert Wilson's Temptation to St. Anthony, when Dr. Regan realized that Marcel could play tambourine, she assigned her that role, that she should always have her tambourine, and that she must never forget it. You know, Dr. Regan, in this wonderful way, I mean, yes, she had a voice, but Dr. Regan is like, you know, every rehearsal is like, you know, Marcel, where is your tambourine? You know, I need you to, and the Marcel would always bring this tambourine, because for her it was second nature, but not something that, you know, people outside of the culture of church had necessarily celebrated. Not that Dr. Regan was outside of the culture of church, but we were in theater, and so Marcel hadn't thought of bringing her tambourine to every rehearsal. And so now she's always playing her tambourine. You know? So it's that's my opinion. She might have a different story, but honestly, I remember that very clearly.
I also noticed, as I was gathering information on you to have this discussion, you've created a family.
Absolutely.
A family has been created around you. Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, being a product of foster care, I guess one of the lessons that I've learned is that the family you have is the family that you nourish, the family that you make. They don't necessarily have to be blood relatives. I love long-term relationships. I'm very monogamous. And when I say monogamous, I don't just mean sexually. I mean spiritually. I love to be in relationship, long, long, lifelong relationships with people that have meaning and value to my life. And it will mean the world to me to die knowing that there are still people in my life who've been there since I was a child. Hence, my love, my respect, my ultimate admiration, appreciation for Helga Davis, Marcel Lashley, Toshi Regan, Nona Hendricks, people who have just remained in my life forever, people who I can always call on, not just for performances, but for birthdays or for holidays, or, you know, these people come to my house for Thanksgiving dinners or New Year's parties, or we get together socially. Crystalline Wright, Ron Brown, who I've known, the choreographer, since we were teenagers. These are important relationships, and for very good reasons. I feel like, you know, they were placed in my life for a reason, you know, and by no mistake. And they are absolutely my family, and very, very important to me, and have always been my family. They've always had my back, and always, when I didn't have my back, they've had my back. So, yeah, that's what family is to me. It's the family you make, and I'm very, very fortunate.
In fact, I would like to, before I get to the release, I want you to talk about, because I remember mentioning it when I met you for the Abby Lincoln special, and I noticed that you had been teaching in institutions, and as far as I know, you don't have a doctorate.
No.
And you had explained to me how you were able to do that.
I've won the Herb Alpert Prize, which is an arts prize. I was invited to, well, I've been invited to teach different places before that, but I'd won the Herb Alpert Prize. The Alpert Prize has a relationship with the California Institute for the Arts. Part of winning the prize is that you have to do a residency at CalArts. I went out to Los Angeles, was there, did a residency, came back. They asked me back again to do another one. I went back. This is around the time that Susan Laurie Parks had just started to create their playwriting department. And Susan and I have been, you know, old friends for years from the Public Theater George Wolfe days. And Susan also had been an Alpert winner. And so Susan, let me get the timing right. Let me see. She won the Pulitzer for Top Dog Underdog and left CalArts, and I was asked to replace her. Eric N. was dean at the time, was a playwright. They didn't have anybody to replace Susan. They thought that I would be the right person, so I came in to take over, because I think Susan hadn't been there very long. She created the department and had been there maybe a year or two before she left. So I came in and I took the department over, the writing department, and then that was the first time that I was head of a department for 3 years. Then I left, and then I taught at Brown, and then I taught at Hans, and on and on in different places, but yeah.
And I think I had asked, I was like, okay, if you don't have a doctorate, how'd you wind up doing all that stuff?
Academia is a funny place. I think that on one level, Baldwin taught, and Baldwin didn't have a college degree. You know, academia is a very interesting place. I mean, it's sort of a, sometimes because of your body of work, you can find yourself invited into certain institutions because you published this, that, or the other. And sometimes not. So I never sought academia out. Academia sought me out. And I'm not teaching now because I'm not interested in it right now. Like right now, I just want to get back to my work. I want to get back to art and all that.
Which leads us to this latest recording.
Somehow.
Ooh, yeah.
Right.
Homeostasis.
Yes.
How did it come about?
I got tired of academia and I...
That's right.
No, I didn't get tired of academia. But, you know, anybody who teaches will tell you that it's, you know, you give a lot and a lot of it is expected of you, and which is wonderful, very redeeming. But I felt an absence in my artistic output. You know, I wanted to get back to writing plays. I wanted to get back to writing novels. I wanted to get back to going to the studio. And I, interestingly enough, I would honestly say that what is homeostasis comes about sort of because of radio in a way. I mean, because I started to host a bit, you know, at the Green Space.
On WNYC.
Okay, on WNYC. And I did like a bebop show, and it would be either me and Randy Weston or me and Gerald Clayton or, you know, other, which was great. So I started to perform again, and again, I had this wonderful relationship, which I love and cherish, with musicians again. Mm-hmm. And then I really became interested in making a record that was jazz influenced, mm-hmm. but not a jazz record, but had more of a jazz bass than had any of my prior recordings. Mm-hmm. At this time, I started listening a lot to these radio documentaries about Sinatra or Billy in the Studio or whoever, and, you know, these Nelson Riddle orchestrations, yeah. and, you know, somebody writing up charts and right. da-da-da, and, you know, there's also, you know, you listen to Phil Schaff for about 3 hours and you take it into this world, you know, and I'm like, oh, this is fascinating.
Right. Da-da-da. WKCR.
Right, exactly, WKCR. And so then I'm like, well, this is, you know, I wonder what that would be. Who arrangements, and, you know, who did their arrangements, who did their charts, and who did their this and their that.
Right.
And I'm like, well, who does my arrangements? Nobody's ever arranged. Nobody's ever done. I've never asked anybody to make me do my arrangements. You know, I love that idea. You know, or my orchestration.
Right.
You know, this whole thing. You know, because basically in the contemporary recording world, you have a producer,
right.
you have songwriters, you have the artists, and you hit it, right?
Right.
So we don't really speak in that way. And I became interested. I was like, what is that? You know, I'd like to get back to that. I'd like to see what that would mean to me.
Mm.
You know, what would it mean to my voice? What would it mean to a record? What would it mean to my music if I started to think about the arrangement of the music, or sort of separate out, you know, the writing of the song from the arrangement of the song, from the production of the song, and on and on, and the recording of it. And then I went to Pat Cruz's apartment.
Of
Pat Cruz is the, right, she's the executive director of Harlem Stage.
Mm-hmm.
She is also the widow of the late great artist Emilio Cruz.
Mm.
Her home is filled with some of the most beautiful paintings and sculptures you ever want to see by her husband. And every time I'm in her apartment, I am just drawn into this world of the late, great Emilio Cruz and his imagination and a series of paintings that he had titled Homeostasis.
Yeah.
And I think also he'd written a play called The Homeostasis of Something, Something Being or whatever. At that time, I was thinking about the state of the world, the politics, what was happening in the world, what was happening for me. I was thinking about the need for balance. And so I decided that this next record I would make would be called Homeostasis, that would be the mission of it, that the mission of it, if there was, or the thesis of it, would be balance, self-balance, world balance, social balance, cultural balance, life balance. And it would be an ode, in a way, to Emilio Cruz's work. And it would also be an ode to jazz and to music that I think I had never brought into the fore seriously enough in a way that I had wanted to. So also a tribute to my parents. A record maybe I think my parents might or might not, but might have appreciated. Something I think that they could listen to work in a way that I had not worked prior. To still be a poet, but to still be a singer, and above all, to be a musician. And that was the creation of Homeostasis. And my manager thought it was a great idea and said, let's do it.
Who's Hamilton Kirby?
Hamilton Kirby is a very young 21 or 2-year-old musician that my manager introduced me to. He lives in Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
His father is head of the music department of the University of North Carolina at Asheville. Hamilton Kirby is a southern white boy who listens to black southern hip-hop, and his father was a classically trained musician who made some records with Debbie Harry in the 60s.
Wow.
And in the psychedelic area.
Wait. Debbie Harry?
Uh-huh.
From Blondie,
before Blondie.
In the
60s. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my.
Right, and was her boyfriend, right.
Okay.
So his father had, there was a band, I forgot the name of the band, but mm-hmm. the father and Debbie Harry, they had a band, they had one record, and then his father moved on to do arrangements for Liberace. Okay. His father has all this, and also, when I went down to visit my manager and hang out with his father also was playing Moondog and, you know, all these other kinds of records for me and Allen Ginsberg records and just
wow.
all these things. I knew Allen Ginsberg, and so, I mean, that was interesting. So, interestingly enough, I like to think I became a bridge between Hamilton Kirby and his father, Wayne Kirby. I'm trying to broaden the son's knowledge of music, and I'm a little older than him, but I'm also younger than his father.
Mm-hmm.
So it became an interesting conversation mm-hmm. between the three of us about music and a way, I think, for the three of us to get into the studio and to begin to... I know that I had a mission first, which was to try to get Wayne Kirby to appreciate what his son did more
mm-hmm.
and to try to get his son... Hamilton to appreciate what his father knew.
Right.
And in their mutual respect for me, we were able to find this sort of interesting synthesis.
Nice. So Hamilton actually came up with some of the beats, or?
Yeah, there's some tracks where you came up with either beats
mm-hmm.
or we would write together.
Okay.
I've always had a collaborative songwriting partner.
Sure.
I've always had somebody who I need to bounce ideas off of. Yeah, so I really say that he was sort of a co-songwriter and sometimes came up with beats, but it's not just beats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was larger than that. There were times when he would even also, we would talk about, you know, what this song should sound like, or sometimes Hamilton plays all these instruments as
okay.
well. He plays guitar, he plays piano, you know, he's a laptop DJ,
mm-hmm.
you know, so sometimes he'd just pick up a guitar and just start playing, and I would sit there and start singing and transcribing what I was singing, and then we'd say, oh, this is great, let's change this here. So he really became a songwriting partner.
And, you know, there are other folks involved in this, too. There's
Lonkheiser is a former Cal Arts student. He was not there when I was there, though. His wife had been trying to get he and I together. He's a mad genius, a brilliant guy who loves classical music and jazz music, and he's an absolute genius and lived in Fort Greene for a while and was a music teacher. We started to hang out a bit. I started to talk to him about these Nelson Riddle orchestrations and what have you,
uh-huh.
and charts, and, you know, I went over to his house a couple of times. So he's the other force on this record. He became a songwriting partner, and that's really how Homemade Spaces began, really between Hamilton, Wayne, and Lon.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Cool. Now, you brought your family back.
That's right. Always.
And other sort of Black Rock Coalition type Burnt Sugar people
were
on
like,
here.
Like Ben Tyree and
Dave
Smooth Smith.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And that's because I was doing these Black Rock Coalition or Burnt Sugar shows in Lincoln Center and started to meet these other musicians.
There was the Gil Scott Heron
tribute. The Gil Scott Heron tribute, exactly.
There were a couple of Gil Scott Heron tributes,
exactly,
actually.
That I did.
Mm-hmm.
The one at Symphony Space, the one at Lincoln Center. Then we did I was with them in Paris, which wasn't a Gil Scott Heron tribute, it was Steely Dan tribute.
Oh,
right, then we did the Steely Dan tribute, so I was part of that, and I started to meet some of the... But I've always known Greg, and always known the musicians, and always known Vernon Reed,
mm-hmm.
and Vernon had always collaborated with me, because Vernon had worked with me on Gilbert Alley. I've worked on one of Vernon's records. So Vernon Reed and I co-wrote Lies on the Gilbert Alley CD.
I told a lie, my life, that I, oh yeah, oh my. Thank you. different.
No thought, no hunger.
Except the need to rise. Hold that beat other side. Where the air breathes out. Under the sun in the past. Color of night. Bed flow deep down a thousand rows. Cut across your face. Push you into me. Silent, please. Silent, please. Silent, please. Silent, please be.
Silent speaks softly. Right. She sounds like Billie Holiday.
Yeah.
And was that the plan?
Yeah, that was a bit of the plan, exactly. I was in the studio, to be honest, and recording the song, had this idea, and then I called her on the phone while I was in the studio. I sang that part to her, and I was like, kind of say like Billie. I was like, you know, kind of like,
silence.
You know, and I was like, whatever I was doing. Right. And, you know, we were laughing. We were totally having fun.
Right.
And then I put the phone up to the mic in the recording studio. So she's recording over the phone in the studio.
Very old school.
This, yes, exactly. To get this whole, you know, effect, you know, that whatever, so it would have that sound.
Oh,
and then I kept it, yeah.
Excellent. The sound is so clean.
That's Dave Darlington, man. He's a great engineer. Absolutely.
And Nona Hendricks, she's on Razor and Blade. That is an amazing song.
Oh, thanks.
I mean, it is like, both of you are like, just ripping it on that.
Yeah,
I mean, everybody is ripping it.
Yeah, we're being crazy. You know what's great about that song for me is that I'm kind of being in character, and it's a character. I did a record that's never come out, which is the first record that I ever did before the Rush Review record, and it was the one that Nona produced, which is called Cornbread Cognac Collard Green Revolution.
Wow.
And on that album, I used to have a record called Human This Morning. And I created a character, a homeless man, you know, sort of with a gospel trio. He had, like, gospel backup singers. And he would go through the train begging for money, you know.
Right.
And he would talk to the people. He'd be like, excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. I ain't trying to buy nobody. When we recorded, it was like Nona, Marcel, and Helga wailing behind me, you know, like, yeah. And the character sucks some people off. Like, you know, I know I don't look right this morning, and I smell too good. You're on your way to your job. I just want to feel human. You know, like, I had this whole little character. So I kind of brought that character back for working on out when I was doing the thing with Nona a little bit, which is really funny. That was the, let me revisit the little crazy man character. And,
yeah, I like that one. I like that one a lot. Vijay Iyer is on here.
Yes, he is. I love having Vijay just for the...
It was an intro.
Yeah,
he plays an intro.
He plays an intro. He plays the piano intro.
Yeah.
color. Mm-hmm. I wanted that Vijay Iyer piano intro color, mm-hmm. you know. So there are these references, these odd little things, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's how his music is. It's not, like, straightforward.
Right.
He goes everywhere.
I mean, he's responding to what's been mm-hmm. while he's also trying to make.
Right.
And I think that's very important.
Right. And Vernon is on this one.
Right. Yeah, he plays guitar on
Silence.
On Silence.
Softly.
Yes,
yeah.
He does, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it sounds great. It really does. And you're going to be at the Apollo.
I am. I'm so excited. 19th and 20th.
Yes. That's Friday and Saturday, April 19th and April 20th.
Right.
You're doing two different things on each night.
That's right. On the 19th, the show is primarily what I'm calling a Rux Revue night. Doesn't mean I'm only doing songs from Rux Revue. I'm doing songs from Rux Revue, Gabri Alley, and Apothecary RS. All the records that I've recorded heretofore.
Right.
And on the Saturday night, I am doing... All the music is from the new album, Homeostasis. Okay. So I just wanted to separate them out. Because I didn't feel like they lived in the same evening.
Mm.
And I couldn't figure out how to get them into the same evening. How to make that set work.
Uh-huh.
You know? And so I decided to separate them. And I'm very glad that I did. So the first night will be old school Carl Hengar Grux. The second night will be new school Carl Hengar Grux. But it's all Carl Hengar Grux.
And the second night, Saturday the 20th, Homeostasis will be available for those to obtain.
Exactly. And Nona Hendrix will be performing with me that night.
Okay.
And Martha Redbone will be there performing mm-hmm. with me that night.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the other people you mentioned, Ben Tyree and Kate Smooter Smith and Burn Sugar. And it's going to be a very exciting night.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, is there anything else you want to tell the WBAI listenership as we wrap up?
Oh, my God. I love the WBAI radio station. And I love the conversations that I have with you guys. Honestly, I really do. I really, really appreciate you being here. And talking to you about this music. And I really hope that people come through. I think that it's going to be a fun night for music and a fun night at the Apollo. It's a cultural institution. It's a landmark. And it's ever-evolving. And I'm really happy to be a part of its continuance, its evolution.
Well, thank you, Carl Hengar Grux, for allowing me to share your space and for giving us all this time.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Carl Hengar Grux. My name's Joyce Jones. This is Sugar in My Bowl. You've been listening to Sugar in My Bowl. What you're listening to right now is... What is it? Razor and Blade. Work It On Out. By Carl Hengar Grux. Yeah, we don't have too much time. I need to get up out of here because La Nueva Alternativa will start soon. But I have a little treat for you after the show ends. Yeah, I made that promo. Oh, by the way, let me say, yes, you are listening to Razor and Blade from Homeostasis. Before that, we heard Silence Speak Softly from Homeostasis. Actually, we heard the piano intro that was played by Vijay Iyer on... Where are my cymbals? You'll find out if you get the CD. On Homeostasis, actually. Isn't it? Yeah, Homeostasis, the title cut. Let's see, before that we heard Silence Speak Softly to Me, Silence Speak Softly, actually. Martha Redbone's on that one, and Vernon Reed, as mentioned. Before that, actually, I wanted to clarify, Lou Kaiser is the name. If you couldn't make it out, he's the force that was mentioned, along with, Hamilton Kirby and, Wayne Kirby. Now, let's see. Before that, we heard Mingus Meditations. That was Gene Lee. And that was Dave Holland on the bass. So, yay. Before that, we heard El Mina Blues Opus. And if I left anything out, we'll have everything up on the sugarinmybowl.org website, a playlist soon come. And a little, perhaps we'll provide a Carl Hengar Grux web extra. But, Stay tuned now for La Nueva Alternativa, coming up now, soon, at 1 a.m.
Listening to WBAI in New York.